noting with sorrow the death of fellow Libran KPFA programmer Veronica Faisant, who is wise, spicy, witty, underestimated. I just love Veronica once when I was saying to her about a common circumstance going, I'm not sure I feel very appreciated. And she said, no one does, Caroline, no one does. So in keeping with our fabulous guest I will be bringing on in moments, I love the apocryphal story of St. Patrick, who was offered a cup of poisoned wine at a dinner, and he holds the cup up to the light. The poison rises to the top. He blows it off like froth on a Guinness. And he quaffs the drink and toasts everyone, even those who tried to poison him, causing the elders to go, ah, a real initiate. So we all say we've been given a cup of poisoned wine, and what shall we do? So here to help transmute that poison, we dive into how should America act in the world? And we welcome the return of Stephen Kinzer, a great narrative guide of liberating lucidity in regard to the roots of American empire and U.S. messing with so many nations' elections. Just to keep our perspective now, deep delving and prolific, he is the author of All the Shah's Men, we hosted him then, and many other essential books for understanding America and Iran and Turkey and Rwanda and Hawaii and Iraq and Nicaragua. His latest book, The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire, we'll be honoring, as well as wherever he wants to go. Former New York Times foreign correspondent, Boston Globe columnist, senior fellow, Watson Institute for Public Affairs at Brown University Global, StephenKinzer.com. Welcome, Stephen.
Great to be with you.
That's great. So I have perused this rousing thing, and I think of you, you know, everywhere there's a dark conspiracy to make Americans stupid. So I view you as illuminating that dark conspiracy and how we really do want to journey backwards to find the roots. You start with 1898, and we want to even in our brief time together, it's an hour, we can unfurl, but you know, go all the way to Obama, but stopping with Mark Twain's fantastic oratory. But you know, we do want to know history. Doing so much of it, so shall you dive us into the crucial thing of 1898-1899?
First of all, let me pull back and refer to something that you just said a couple of minutes ago, which has to do with how we get to where we are. So I've had the idea for over a number of years that I wanted to write a memoir, all my everything I did as a foreign correspondent, all the wars I saw and the people I met. However, my publisher has told me, and this has been confirmed by other people in the business, that this is not a good idea because nobody buys memoirs by journalists except for other journalists, and that's not a good enough market, so forget that idea. So I'm not going to write a memoir. However, I have a title for my memoir, so I'm not going to write it. Usually I write the book first, then I come up with the title. Now I have a title for a book that's never going to exist, but it embodies my view of the world and what I hope Americans would embrace. So my title comes from an old black and white movie that some of your listeners might remember. That's a movie called Arsenic and the Old Lace with Cary Grant. So as you may remember, in that movie, the story is that Cary Grant goes to visit his elderly aunt to run a rooming house, and he realizes that they poison the guests. That's the conceit of the movie. But there's a great line in that movie. There's a point where Cary Grant is talking to his aunts, and one of the aunts says, oh, the gentleman died because he drank wine that had poison in it. And Cary Grant's eyes start to pop out, and he says, but how did the poison get in the wine? That's the title of my never-to-be-written book. How did poison get in
the wine?
So we know that the wine of world peace has been poisoned, but how did the poison get in the wine? That's what I've dedicated my career to trying to answer.
Well, but also surely your career is dedicated to answering how do we get it out of the wine, too, like St. Patrick.
It's, of course, much more difficult to pull poison out. And not all of us have the abilities that St. Patrick had to just blow it off the top of the froth.
Well, we're being mythologically helped that way. Let everybody imagine. We've all been given a poison cup of wine, but certainly America, too. And that, in a sense, your book, The True Flag, is about the poison cup of wine. And you actually do, well, yes, of course, you go into how did it get there. And there's, you know, many answers, but it's amazing to see all these names surfacing and, you know, that are, Henry Cabot Lodge and, you know, Theodore Roosevelt and Mark Twain, of course, and all of the complexity, because Mark Twain, you know, I was checking out his commentary on Syria. He was all for Russian intervention to destroy the Turks and the Ottoman Empire. And then you do a great job of, like, he changed his mind, you know, about a lot of things, right?
All of my books are voyages of discovery. I'm always looking for some hugely important event that shaped America and the world, but that we don't know about, something that's fallen out of history books for various reasons. So in this book, The True Flag, which just came out in paperback this month, I've tried to recover what is really the founding debate in the history of American foreign policy. That was the moment when we had to decide, do we want to become an overseas empire? Do we want to start influencing the politics of other countries? This was an enormous debate. The entire U.S. was caught up in this. It was on the front pages of newspapers for months. Every major political and intellectual figure took sides. They're having the debate that we should be having now. I envy the people in my book. That was something that I came to realize as I was writing it. I wish we could have the profound debate that they had then, and we perhaps would produce figures like Mark Twain. That was a subsidiary discovery of my book. So the main discovery I made was that this debate ever happened, because we don't learn about it in schools and it's not in our school books. But one of the other discoveries I made did have to do with Mark Twain. So I grew up with what I now realize is a quite partial and distorted view of Twain. I always thought of him as Mr. Nice Guy. He had nice curly white hair. Everybody loved him. He was like your slightly eccentric favorite uncle. He would rock on his porch and tell stories that everybody laughed at. It was a very gentle figure. This is not correct. Mark Twain was a vituperative anti-imperialist. His writings are bitter. They're angry. And you don't find most of those quotes in any biography or anthology of Mark Twain. So I'm trying in my book to recover the real essence of the sharpness of Mark Twain. So he believed, as he wrote, that Americans fighting in foreign wars were carrying a bandit's musket under a polluted flag. And he even wanted to change the flag of the United States to replace the stars with skull and crossbones.
Yeah, that's
he really
great.
He was a figure who speaks to us today.
Right. No, and we do want more witty sizzle. And you delineate also, he played the proper role of court jester and trickster when he was at a dinner and ran across Vice President Teddy Roosevelt, who was that at the time attending, and he couldn't resist. That's really not. Right. We need more of that, right?
I wish we had some of those voices today. But more important, I think it would be great if our American press was more open to reporting the variety of opinions and views that make this debate so rich. Instead, our press, of which I was a part for many years, has contributed to this kind of monochromatic narrative that we have. The press sort of is in between the neocon and liberal interventionist opinions. Beyond that, it doesn't go. Almost all columnists for major newspapers are in that spectrum, and our press also embraces the view that the U.S. is the indispensable nation. Whenever there's trouble in the world, the United States has to get involved. American military intervention is what saves people's lives and creates freedom and democracy. If you don't believe all that stuff, it's really difficult to penetrate into the American press. And this is something that's been true for a long time. However, at least in those days, we had an open debate, and the anti-imperialist league, which played a huge role in American politics in the period around the 1898, 1900, 1902, had as its leaders some of the most impressive figures in America, not just Mark Twain, but a great range of figures from millionaire tycoons like Andrew Carnegie to social reformers like Jane Addams and Booker T. Washington and Samuel Gompers. You had two former presidents involved. The anti-imperialist movement was a major force in American life. It had hundreds of meetings around the country, produced millions of broadsides about why we should not take the Philippines, why we should not take Puerto Rico, why we should concentrate on building democracy at home instead of trying to project power abroad. So this was a great resource, and I'm trying to use this book, The True Flag, in a way to recover the legacy of those great anti-imperialists and show you how relevant their arguments were to today. Now, one thing I learned in writing this book and in going through the congressional debates, there was a 34-day debate in the U.S. Senate over this grand question, is that every argument that we now use in the debates over whether we should intervene in Vietnam, Nicaragua, Iraq, all go back to the great original debate in the first couple of months of 1899. This was a fantastic debate over whether the United States should set off on the course of overseas empire or not. And every great theme starts there. This is really, in the history of American foreign policy, the mother of all debates. And I'm trying to recover that. And as I said earlier, I wish we could have the kind of deep debate that they had now, because we need it now more than ever.
Absolutely. No, and may your wish be granted, just for the hell of it. It's also you're reminding us that even as late as what, the 20s and 30s, all across America in medium small cities, Baltimore and Providence and everything, there was, you know, really strong working class public debate in which people would gather and talk about what is the role of government and all kinds of stuff. So yes, this stupefaction, the conspiracy, but yeah, and the spiciness of Twain's great satire. Now, I always knew that about him. And you say it's the wickedest paragraph in the literature of American anti-imperialism. And you did finish with the end going, we can have a special flag, our states do, our usual flag with the white stripes painted black and the stars replaced by the skull and crossbones, as you say. But yeah, it's an unsnookering, and I view your dedicated work as, you know, may we be unsnookerable, not bamboozleable, because all the things that you point out are completely resonantly pertinent to now. The anti-immigration thing, you know, the divided soul, but you know, the idea of, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, boo, you know, I mean, a dynamic, extraordinary, experimental arrangement of molecules, but as you say, the dusky lands could only be truly free when outsiders govern them, is what you write, and that's kind of Teddy's heartfelt thing, as well as his love of destroying animals and whatnot. So yeah, it does go back to that. And you say, you know, I actually looked up June 15th, 1898. You say because there was the great, I guess it wasn't a debate, it was a presentation at Faneuil Hall in Boston, simultaneous with Congress meeting to vote on, correct and guide me here, you know, intervention in Hawaii and the Philippines and Cuba and on and on, right?
Yes, so June 15th, 1898 is the scene with which I open my book. That was the day when we had the first anti-imperialist meeting in American history, a public meeting. So it was held in Faneuil Hall in Boston. And the speakers all argued that we went to war in Cuba to liberate Cubans from Spanish oppression. But after we started the war, we found out that actually the war had another purpose. The purpose wasn't just to liberate Cubans. It was to subject Cubans to American rule and to take over other islands, including Puerto Rico, the Philippines, Guam, and set us off on this course of empire. So on that same day, Congress was debating taking the first American territory, Hawaii. And let me just read you a couple of sentences from the opening speech of that anti-imperialist meeting at Faneuil Hall. This was Charles Ames. He was a prominent Unitarian clergyman who had traveled the world promoting peace projects. He told that meeting at Faneuil Hall in 1898 this following thing. He said, "The policy of imperialism threatens to change the temper of our people and to put us into a permanent attitude of arrogance, testiness, and defiance toward other nations. Once we enter the field of international conflict as a great military and naval power, we shall be one more bully among bullies. We shall only add one more to the list of oppressors of mankind." That is so true. What he foresaw came true. The idea that the U.S. should dominate the world and tell other countries what to do really did transform us. It made us into a country that thinks that, as Madeleine Albright said, we are the indispensable nation. We stand taller. We see further. And this is this self-indulgent attitude that so many Americans over generations have assimilated. The idea that the rest of the world will be in chaos and misery and poverty unless the United States intervenes. And as soon as you have a government in your country that follows what the United States wants, you'll be happy. If you don't, we're going to bomb you and pressure you until you produce such a government.
Yes, and many of that's a great thing you just read. I have it highlighted in yellow here going because I do want to tout with complete authentic sincerity. Really, this book should be in every library, and it's really useful if you want to understand now or American history, if you want to be unbamboozled as an American, you know, to know history. Thank you, Stephen Kinzer, for this invaluable work. But somebody also then was saying, you know, once you do this, you know, you can't go back. It's like returning a rental car, you know, the spikes, you can't back up, you know, it's very hard to go back. And they do talk about, you know, how terrible for a colony to begin taking colonies, and quoting Jefferson, nothing to do with conquest and all of that. And you say it's the divided American soul, which still is. So is that also the birth of the ridiculous concept of American exceptionalism? Is that what this is?
It's true that it's difficult to go back once we decide that the world will be in chaos and misery and sorrow without American intervention. It's hard to believe they can live without us. Was it the birth of American exceptionalism? I'm not sure. I think Americans had believed for a long time that we were kind of a special chosen people. God gave us this great unpopulated continent, as we thought that it was, and told us we could do whatever we wanted with it. But something very important happened in 1898. I think you can look at the history of American expansion in three phases. So first, you might call it continental empire. That was fulfilling what we were told was our manifest destiny, to fill up North America. So by wiping out Indian tribes and seizing one-third of Mexico, we completed that. We achieved our goal of continental empire. We fulfilled our manifest destiny. That was done by 1898. Then we had this great question. So what do we do now? We got to the edge of California, and we've filled up our country. So shall we now concentrate on building up our own country and making it into a model for the world? Or, having been expansionists ever since the Pilgrims moved from Plymouth to Boston, should we just continue expanding beyond our borders? In 1899, actually, we made that decision. The Senate decided with a vote of one vote more than the required majority to go ahead, seize those islands. And that set us into our second phase. We became an overseas empire rather than simply a continental empire. And that continued for another half century until the period after the Second World War, when we moved into what I would call our third phase, which was global empire. Everything is part of our empire. So the exceptionalist idea is not in itself the center of the problem. It's how you interpret that. Does exceptionalism mean that we should try to build what was once called a city on a hill so all people would admire us? Or does exceptionalism mean that every country should be like us, that we've discovered the one way to run a country? And I think this is something that we have now embraced and that many of us believe. It's certainly the principal underlying belief in Washington. There's one way to run a country that's good, and it's our way. The closer you are to our way, the better you are. And if you don't want to run a country like ours, if you want to elect or produce leaders who support the interests of their own country ahead of the interests of the United States, then we will consider you to be an enemy and lash out against you. So that interpretation of the exceptionalist idea, that it requires everyone to be like us, is what has brought us to our present grief in the world.
Right, but as you guide us, you know, even that is a fig leaf on top of naked greed, because it's not like, oh, let's have them really have a democracy, because over and over again, and this is so crucial for us all to metabolize this poison in the wine, you know, the betrayals. You know, in a sense, the betrayals. Also, George Washington promised the slaves and the Yoruba people in New York City and New York State that they would be free if they fought for the revolution, and then afterwards he's like, it's not really possible. Sorry about that. And then, you know, you into now, or into the 19th century, into 20th, you know, and the meeting with the Filipino radical leaders, you know, how wonderful, and the agreement that apparently is struck, you know, we will help you to throw off the oppressor, and then you will have your own democracy, you know, and then, you know, Ho Chi Minh, I mean, all of that, it's the broken promises. So it's not really that we want everybody to be like American democracy. I mean, that would be an imposition too. But as you've delineated also, I'm pretty sure in All the Shah's Men, where we conversed about that, a great book on Iran, America, crucial to understand now. It's all incredibly pertinent. You know, but, you know, the actual obstruction of democratic, intrinsic, indigenous democratic process, and that Iran in the 1920s really, you know, was at a democracy, and Churchill was like, no, absolutely not, you know, and then on. So the not only yeah, the broken promise theme, you know, runs through this, which is a useful thing for us everybody to metabolize. But it's so pertinent now, because you go, you know, there's the foppish dude, the, you know, Teddy Roosevelt guy, the blustering, charismatic figure. It's like, okay, this is resonant. Americans are suckers for that, or half are, you know, and maybe this is the horrific cartoon that breaks the spell. Is that, you know, is that a wish that you would have?
It's certainly true that Americans are caught up in this fantasy that whenever we show up, tyranny and dictatorship retreats and collapses under our demand for freedom and democracy. But actually, if you look at the history of these interventions, they have rarely been used to overthrow tyrants and promote true democracies. In fact, they promote the opposite. So what I find remarkable is the extent to which Americans have come to accept this fantasy, which truly is contradicted by history, that the United States is actually acting in the world on behalf of the interest of the world's people. In fact, we have adopted the idea that we know what's good for the world better than the world itself knows. And the countries that don't want our help, that don't want us to come in and tell them what's the right way to run their country, have proven by that fact that they're so backward that they are the ones that need our intervention the most. So it's this contrast between the reality of what we do and the fantasy that's so interesting in America. And it's truly remarkable that we've been able to sell to Americans this idea that all of our interventions, all of our bombings, all of our overthrowing of foreign governments actually are, in a way, to help the victims of our intervention. Now, let me just add one other little detail before I forget. So you mentioned All the Shah's Men, my book about the overthrow of the government of Iran in 1953. That book has been made into a play, and the play is going to have its world premiere in San Francisco in May.
Fabulous.
So I'm flying out there to see it, and I hope those of you that are in the Bay Area will get a chance to go over there. I think this will be a great theatrical moment when we can try to transform some of these rants that we do on the radio onto the actual stage.
So somebody will be playing Kermit Roosevelt. Yes.
Exactly. Someone will be playing the Shah. Someone will be playing Mohammed Mossadegh.
Right. Yeah, because as we discoursed last time, you know, we're all, you know, all our lives are spiritual detective novels. So, as I told you, you know, that my childhood second grade friend Anne Roosevelt, her father was Kermit, right? Who you know, I tell that to Iranian allies, and they're like, "Oh, the devil!" I go, "Yeah, I know," but he was this henpecked, wimpy, you know, tyranny really is compensatory. We need him, guy who didn't need much. He needed some newspapers, like, you know, you can tie it back to Hearst. He needed like $40,000, you know, and to stir up riots and stuff. And the second time it worked. But I did say to my childhood friend when we were like 7, 6, you know, "Your father is like a large rabbit in a bathrobe with a gun." I knew on some level, again, this dangerously kind of weak person was doing mayhem. But yes, that is essential to know about. And that is a great book. I've actually read it twice. So that's really good. But also satire, you know, which Twain is so good at, and Americans, you know, may it be that, you know, there's a satire illiteracy that's being addressed, but whenever you put, you know, Andy Borowitz out, people go, "Is this real news?" It's satire, Americans. But it's so savvy. You know, the Celt said only satire could bring down the unruly, power-abusing guy. And just the little opening lines that you have here of Twain: "There have been lies, yes, but they were told in a good cause. We have been treacherous, yes, but that was only in order that real good might come out of apparent evil. True, we have crushed a deceived and confiding people. We've turned against the weak and the friendless who trusted us. We've stamped out a just and intelligent and well-ordered republic. We've stabbed an ally in the back and slapped the face of a guest. We have bought a shadow from an enemy that hadn't it to sell." It goes, "We've robbed a trusted friend." It's really good.
Twain was really a poison pen, and we are so in need of someone
we
like that
are.
Now. But actually, I wish we could just raise him back. If we could only show Americans the radical essence of some of these people who have been kind of bleached and cleansed of their militancy, we would realize that the idea that America should leave other countries alone and focus on making building democracy at home instead of forcing our idea of democracy on others is not a new idea. So one of the purposes of my book is to make people who are activists in this anti-imperialist movement, who are appalled by the death that has been spread by American interventions, to realize that they're not inventing something new. This is not a new idea in American history. Actually, although you wouldn't know it from reading your history books, this is a rich American tradition. The idea of anti-imperialism, the idea that the United States exists to respect other countries, to promote the independence of all nations, and to resist the imposition of power by giant nations on poor countries, is a very old American tradition. People who are promoting these ideas today are standing on the shoulders of giants. And so yes. I'm trying to recover some of those original stories and make clear how rich this tradition is.
That's great. And we're going to do more of it. We're going to take a very, very short break, a little musical break for Station ID. This is Visionary Activist Show, KPFA. And our wonderful guest is Stephen Kinzer. And the book we are talking about is The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. And we will be right back after this very short break.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Ooh, chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Grab my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and our splendid guest and narrator, Stephen Kinzer, whose latest book, The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire, is just out in paperback. Rush to get that and give copies away, because it would be so radical for Americans to be informed of their own history. And as you were saying right before break, to know that this anti-imperialism has roots and intelligence and, you know, strong debate, you know, at that time that we want to resurrect. And also what you're introducing, what you're providing us in this rich proffering of yours. You know, William Jennings Bryan, okay, Christian fundamentalist, but beloved populist, anti-imperialist, you know, we want complexity of perspective, right? And so he was, you know, kind of a rousing force. And so you go, Christian fundamentalist, okay, all right. No, but we'll, you know, allies in all kinds of ways, right?
Absolutely. So the anti-imperialist movement back in the days of 1898-1900 was very rich, and it was very broad. It covered Republicans and Democrats, kind of leftists and rightists, and I think it's a good model, because the principle of that movement was, we don't care what you think about any other issues. This is right. The great issue of the moment. And that was the belief that allowed this coalition to build. Now, today, I find it so frustrating that the idea that the United States should mind its own business in the world and try to build democracy at home instead of abroad is considered some kind of a radical, crazy idea. I love this phrase that John McCain used a few years ago to talk about people who held these views. He called us wacko birds. I want to get a T-shirt or something. I think that's a great phrase. I want to be a wacko bird. That's a wacko bird, by John McCain's description, is someone who doesn't believe that the United States should try to dominate the whole world, and that our discoveries of how countries should be run are scientifically proven to be the peak of all political development in world history. So I like the idea of us being a kind of a wacko bird movement, but the fact is that the anti-imperialist movement was very close to the mainstream of American life for many years. And thanks to the coalition that has emerged between Republicans, Democrats, the press, all the think tanks in Washington, these views have been marginalized, and some of us who hold them have the momentary temptation to believe that there's just a couple of us hiding in the corner and no one else believes this. This isn't true. In fact, large groups of people in the United States don't want their country to be involved in permanent war, which is the situation we're in now. But I'll just tell you this little story. I was in Washington not so long ago, something I hate to do, but I have to do once in a while.
And I'm here forever.
A guy there. Yeah, I met a principal, a figure there who's quite active in world affairs, and I used this phrase. I said, you know, but despite all of everything I've just said in my last rant, the U.S. always pursues this policy of permanent war. And there was a pause, he looked at me a little bit bemused, and he said, you know, here in Washington, we don't call it permanent war. We call it global leadership.
Oh, no. The conniption fits with that.
When I read now and now, that was a good line for me. I begin to understand how people in Washington think that's the only kind of leadership there is in the world, is to bomb and coerce people in other countries.
Well, to keep our metaphor going, that there goes a couple drops of poison in the wine, right? Right there.
Yeah, there have been so many drops over.
So many drops. Well, there's quite a lot. Yeah, but also a crucial part that is pertinent and humming to now too is, you know, you talk about, you know, the in Cuba, right? The destruction of the Maine, which probably self-destructed, but. You know, William Randolph Hearst, you need a corrupt newspaper guy, said this is a great thing. Arouse everybody. This is a war against evil, right? It's like, oh, just... And also a crucial thing that you bring up is that, you know, people who thought that they were fighting, you know, to help lift the, you know, oppressive Spanish colonial rule and kind of to liberate the Cuban freedom fighters hadn't realized until they got there that most of the Cuban, rebel forces were non-white, right? And they were like, we didn't know that part, right? So, but the arouse everybody, it's like, you know, I was seeing on somebody's screen who worked for a media thing, the edict coming down from on high saying, in the reporting of all stories, decrease subtlety and increase urgency, right? It's part of the dark conspiracy to make humans stupid. You know, and that being war against evil, right? So apparently, but maybe it's changing. Let me toss it back to you too. But the war against evil, people have been so easily snookered and bamboozled and hoodwinked into polarity. We are good against evil. But do you sense your wet finger in wind? Is there a shifting tide of possible sanity? I mean, there is.
William Randolph Hearst was a fascinating figure. His role in this is very instructive. It really speaks to us today. So Hearst took over a kind of struggling newspaper that had a circulation of 80,000 in New York City. He wanted to build up its circulation, and he did in a spectacular way. He built it from 80,000 to 800,000, which is probably a unique achievement in American history to have been done over a space of less than a year. How did he do that? Well, Hearst realized something about news, and he realized something about the American people. What he realized about news is that if you want to sell newspapers, or today get people to tune into your show or tune into your website, what you really need is a running story, something that doesn't end. It keeps going day after day, like that plane that fell down in the Pacific. You can just go on and on. The best running story of all is war. It keeps going. So Hearst thought, if I could get the United States involved in a war, anywhere, I could then send reporters there and build up stories about heroism and treason and battles and death. And that would sell lots of newspapers. So he looked around the world and tried to figure out where he could do this. And he saw that there was civil conflict going on in Cuba. And he began to focus on this idea that he could use his newspaper to produce a sentiment that would push the United States into a war. And once the war started, everybody would want to buy his newspapers. So that's the first thing you recognize, something about the press. But then, how do you do that? He would ask himself, so how do you get the American people who really don't know about or much less care about what's happening in X country, in that case it was Cuba, but it could have been Iraq or Libya or Afghanistan or anyone else, how do you get them to the point where they want to go wage war? Well, this is another great insight that Hearst had into the American soul. Americans are very compassionate people. We hate the idea that anybody is suffering anywhere. And when we see the story like today that some poor girl in Afghanistan has been attacked because she tried to go to school, or when we read that in Cuba the Spanish were brutalizing Cuban citizens, the Americans have this idea, we can stop that. If we invade and take over that country, that won't happen. So all you have to do to get Americans excited about going into a war is to tell them that people are being brutalized in that country. We never stop to ask ourselves, okay, they're being brutalized, but would our intervention make them less vulnerable? So we just assume that once we take over, all the evil will stop, and you'll get a beautiful government. It'll be just like Switzerland, and everybody will love each other. This fantasy has never fallen out of our minds from 1898 to today. When we see a country that's suffering or where people are suffering, our first idea is, oh, we should take over that country. So Hearst realized this. He started publishing these amazing stories about the brutalities perpetrated by the Spanish authorities in Cuba. Some of these stories were written by people that had never even been in Cuba, but that didn't matter. He was able to whip Americans up into a frenzy of anger about the oppressions in Cuba. It reminds me a lot of George W. Bush invading Iraq and saying, there won't be any more rape rooms in Saddam Hussein's palace anymore after this invasion. So we have this fantasy that as soon as we invade and take over a country, everything will be peaceful and beautiful. And it's amazing to me how we are able to maintain this fantasy in the face of such repeated evidence that the opposite is actually the case.
Right, and you do take it all the way up at the end of the book to, you know, Obama, you know, again, somebody who enters without statecraft, and you say his two disastrous interventions in the Sudan and then destroying Gaddafi in Libya. Although he did attempt to resist the pressure to reinvade Afghanistan, Iraq, and wanted to put limits on the thing, and well, okay, but yes, that is to toss that back to you. You know, it was a challenging conundrum, right? The Gaddafi thing with the threat of people being killed, and what would you have done, Stephen Kinzer, or what would more statecraft have supplied Obama or anybody at that point to be wiser right then?
If I had been in that room, I would have said, okay, it looks like Gaddafi might be attacking demonstrators in another city. We could be seeing hundreds of people killed in the coming days. That was the situation we faced. So I would have said, okay, hundreds of people may die if we don't intervene. But what's the alternative case? Let's say we do intervene. What's going to happen? Then I would have tried to spin out what actually has wound up happening. We are going to leave Libya decapitated. There won't be a government there. There's no civil society. There's no opposition. There's no professional groups. There's no independent officer corps. There's nobody else who can take over that country. The most likely thing is that it's going to devolve into a terror state where there's nobody in charge. And it will become a source not only of upheaval for the rest of that region, but refugees fleeing into Europe and upsetting politics there. And what I would probably not even have realized was that so many of the weapons that were in Gaddafi's arsenal would wind up being taken out of Libya and spread over all North Africa and the Middle East. So those people in Nigeria, the Shahab, Shabab, and Boko Haram, the people that are kidnapping the girls in Nigeria, they are all using weapons that came from Gaddafi's arsenal. They wouldn't have those weapons had we not invaded. So look around North Africa and see how those weapons have gone. Some of them have even gone to Syria. That's a great example of how the poison gets in the wine. So take me back to that moment in Libya. I would have said, okay, if we don't act, you could have hundreds of dead people, possibly, in the coming weeks in Benghazi. But if we do act, you could have tens of thousands of dead, which is exactly what has happened. So sometimes I think the Americans get motivated by this idea, I'm going to go and save one life. But what about if saving that one life is going to cause 100 deaths in the future? We don't stop to think about the long-term effect.
Right, and many of your wishes. May we have long term vision to think about the, yeah, exactly. But I go that's And that is a triage, difficult conversation to get to going. We write off the 100 people, but just for the whimsical, because you're pretty playful, the whimsical, playful realm going, unexpected repertoire of responses. Gaddafi, we give you a reality show on TV. He loved press. Or we're going to send, you know, these things, or a giant description, or we're opening, you know, a special viewing of Black Panther over here. I mean, completely step out of the paradigm in some way. I'm just to one side. I know your book is very serious, but one side going, well, what would be an unexpected, disruptive, you know, stepping out of that polarity dynamic? I think Gaddafi was an interesting person that could have been conversed with in some form, and certainly what happened is a disaster. But does your playfulness extend to that realm?
I would say that not only was Gaddafi a person with whom we might have had conversations, but we already were having conversations with him.
Right.
And the example of what happened to Gaddafi is really affecting world politics today.
So right, North Korea Gaddafi, will never...
Yeah. With North Korea, I mean, the Gaddafi right. example has shown something very clear. He had a nuclear program. Finally, under our pressure, he agreed to give it up. As soon as he gave it up, we realized he couldn't defend himself, so we launched an operation in which he was overthrown and killed. If you're sitting in North Korea, this has a big lesson, and the lesson is never give up your nuclear weapon. So why did we want to teach the world that you should never give up your nuclear weapons? We should have taught them the opposite. Right. Instead, we've given them this lesson. Everybody should get nuclear weapons, because otherwise they're going to come in and kill you.
Exactly. And I remember I was in Sweden for a long time ago, in the late 80s, you know, and the alternative Nobel Prize people came, and they said, we're pretty savvy, you know. So we sort of bought, you know, Gaddafi. This was Gaddafi being a bad guy in the late 80s, you know. But they said, well, we went to Libya, and actually the rate of literacy and the rate of prosperity and the rate of food and the rate of Al-Qaeda is really pretty good. You know, so again, you know, complexity, may we all be unsnookerable, and certainly, you know, out of the polarity of, you know, even just two choices or good evil kind of a deal, but yeah. And then you dive back. You dive. Well, you take a. You take. Well, let's go. Let's see. We're rich in time. This is good. That you then honor the return of Mark Twain. He's been abroad. October 15th, 1900. He arrives in New York, and maybe he's the first person to refer to wars as quagmires. I mean, he does use that word as he gets off the boat. You know, and he delineates his own journey, I suppose, right, as you write, a conversion from a red hot imperialist. Was that a real part of him, or a sort of faux fictional part that he brought to light?
I think he always was a person who sympathized with the oppressed people in other countries. So Mark Twain and Teddy Roosevelt are the two kind of great opponents who are the center of my book. They were in some ways similar. So both of them were activists and writers, as well as thinkers. So they both had traveled the world. However, they traveled the world for different purposes and come to different conclusions. Roosevelt traveled the world to go to European capitals and to shoot animals in Africa. Mark Twain traveled the world actually in order to meet people and see how they lived. So Roosevelt came away from his world travels and from his education and upbringing with the belief that non-white people were totally unable to govern themselves and needed the Americans to come in and guide them. Mark Twain came away with the opposite view. He believed that those so-called savages that Roosevelt scorned so fully actually were fully formed human beings and could perfectly well govern themselves. So these are really two conflicting views that still have their resonance in American life. There's a strain in American life that tells us, as Madeleine Albright did, that other countries need our guidance. And this is something you hear repeatedly from the Republican-Democrat combination in Washington, that the rest of the world is going to be in chaos without us. The Twain idea is the opposite. The world is going to be in worse shape if we try to go in and bully it and impose ourselves, because actually we don't know what's the best way to govern every country in the world. And the people who live there actually have a better idea than we do. So these two lines, the line that Theodore Roosevelt represented and the one that Mark Twain represented, are still debating inside the United States. But I feel that the people who embrace the Twain idea and would like to see the United States build democracy at home instead of trying to force it on other countries are a little bit in retreat. We're a little bit confused, and we've lost the battle of labels. We're called kind of isolationists or people that want to retreat, whereas those who want to intervene in other countries are thought of as the liberal internationalists. So I would like to see us rebel against this consensus with a little more self-confidence and realize that actually many Americans at this point would like to see a more prudent and restrained foreign policy that would not only support our own security by reducing the number of enemies we create every day, but also liberate resources so that we could address these urgent challenges at home and try to address our own difficulties rather than what we consider to be the difficulties of other countries.
Right. And again, what you delineate is also the kind of the origin, the lies self-told of the CIA, the World Federalists, and, you know, after World War II, and going, oh, idealism, and we want to build peace. But then the CIA whispers, but who better to build peace than Americans, and come this way, and any means necessary was fairly, it's like, no, there you go. But it's also, just to provide us all wonderful, dedicated listeners here, you say there's really a kind of triumvirate that, you know, Teddy Roosevelt needs his ride, right? And his ride is Henry Cabot Lodge. And then they need the William Randolph Hearst, the newspaper guy, and it's that three thing, you know, that's so crucial. And then the pertinence to us, these demons that have not, or the poison that has not been metabolized, we'll keep that going, that's so important, that's way back there, that is right now too, because it's the Roosevelt attributed humanity's rise from barbarism, you write, to the expansion of the peoples of white European blood during the past four centuries. And then, you know, and they're all nakedly into that, which is, that's present now as a horrific poison, right? That same quality, that kind of white nationalist thing, is has risen here now.
You mentioned the triumvirate that I talk about of so Roosevelt as the sort of popular figure who appeals to the American public, Hearst as the mighty megaphone in the press that promotes this all to ordinary people, and then Henry Cabot Lodge working in Washington to make sure that this all gets transformed into public policy. So moving that idea up to today, I have to tell you that from my own perspective, as a person who worked for the New York Times for more than 20 years and was in that capacity a real part of the American press, the most depressing part of this modern triumvirate to me is the role of the press. So I go to Washington, as I mentioned to you, as rarely as possible. But when I do, I'm always struck by the fact that there is an enormous consensus in Washington on this idea that America should keep going and pushing into every country in the world. There is no percentage in Washington in suggesting that the United States might want to do a little less in the world. In fact, we should be always doing more and into more countries. So I understand the political rationale that leads most Republicans and most Democrats and almost every think tank in Washington to jump onto this bandwagon. But what I cannot accept, what I really rebel against, is what I now see in the American press, that the press has joined this consensus. The press is just the megaphone for these interventionist ideals. If you look on the op-ed pages of the major American newspapers, all columnists who write about foreign affairs are in the same line. The way the news is presented is so partial. It's so based on the premise of the American right to intervene in the world, and what a wonderful thing this would be for the rest of the world. So to me, as I grew up, I learned that the press was always supposed to rebel against consensus. When everybody in Washington is saying one thing, the press should be the last ones who look under the rug, who try to say, wait a minute, there's got to be another way to look at this. In the modern age, the press is doing the opposite in this country. We are simply stenographers to power. And that decline of the press into this position is something I find most lamentable in the United States.
Yes. All right. Lickspittles for the ruling class. Okay, there we go. That's just to borrow some Shakespearean language. But okay, in our precious, here we are outroing 1 minute here. But I wanted you to I love the very last page of your book, and also Washington's warnings. And maybe, do you want to just say your last rousing paragraph or whatever you want to say? Any further fervency you want to spiral out into the airwaves?
I did come, while I was writing this book, to become a great admirer of George Washington because of that final speech. He really says that the United States should concentrate on building itself up and not become involved in foreign intrigues. However, in the same speech, he also says, I know you're not going to listen to me. He says, I cannot believe that my words will have the effect that I intend. He sort of realizes that Americans are not going to buy into this idea that there should be some limit to our ambition in the world. So I would love to see us go back to his view. In fact, I've had this fantasy that some year on George Washington's birthday, I would like to go, I'd like to print up some excerpts from that speech and go off to the Boston Public Garden and hand them out under George Washington's statue without his name. And people would try to arrest me and think I was subversive because I was embracing the views that were many of our original founders held.
Absolutely. In the very last sentence of your book, it is late for the United States to change its course in the world, but not too late. That Stephen Kinzer has some optimism, and we'll join you there. Again, quoting Washington on his birthday next year. Absolutely. Stephen's website is stephenkinzer.com. Thanks, Erica Bridgman. Always great board op. And thank you so much, Stephen Kinzer, for your invaluable work. And I'm going to read all your other books, too.
See you in San Francisco for the opening of my play in May.
Fabulous. All right. Thank you. Woof, woof.